Here's the executive director of the NHLPA, Don Fehr. Hi, Don. Thanks a lot for joining us.
How are you?
Good. Thank you for asking. I'm going to paraphrase here, so forgive me if I, and you'll correct me, I know, if I don't accurately portray what happened today. But among the things you said was that the lockout can be avoided, but it's up to the league. Gary comes on 2 hours later and counters by claiming that the PA won't engage us. Tell us what, first of all, did you see Gary's address, and how did you feel about it?
Well, the second question is easy because I did not see it.
Okay.
I was on the phone with players.
First part of the question, he claims you won't engage.
Well, I'm almost at a bit of a loss and chuckling a bit, but I know the seriousness of the situation shouldn't be reflected that way. Look, here's the basic situation that we confront. You had a season lost, massive player concessions over the life of the agreement and the billions of dollars, 7 years of record revenues, even through a financial crisis when things basically fell off a cliff back in 08 for Western economies. And we get to this point, $3.3 billion in revenues, and the response is to say, we got an enormous salary reduction from the players last time. Let's see if we can do it again.
Right.
That seems to be what it is. So they made a proposal initially, right out of the box, which said, we want another 24% plus reduction, and we want to destroy all individual player bargaining rights. And the players at that point had two choices. One choice would have been to do what the owners did and say, okay, instead of 57%, we want 71%. That's the flip side of what the owners did.
Fair.
And then move it down slowly to 68 and then 67. Instead, the players didn't do that. What they said is, look, we don't think you need anything. We don't think you're entitled to anything, but there is a disparity. So we'll do three things, or we'll make a proposal based on three things. First, we will limit future growth so that you can grow your way out of this. We'll take a much smaller share of what it is going forward that you earn until we can get to an equilibrium point. Secondly, we think it's important to have much more significant revenue sharing. And if there's a problem in a given city where they need revenue sharing, and I'll take Phoenix because it's owned by the league at the moment, then the high-income teams, if it's a real problem, ought to be willing to help out with that revenue sharing rather than just take big salary reductions themselves. And then third, if there's a real issue that there ought to be some shared sacrifice, there's got to be some other costs at the NHL or the leagues or somewhere that they would be willing to cut. And their answer appears to be entirely, until the players go backwards absolutely in terms of what their salary levels are, notwithstanding what they did the last time, notwithstanding the revenue increases, notwithstanding the fact that there are no net revenue sharing payments the owners want to make because all they want to make is more than compensated for by the salary reductions, the players are sort of in a hard place to figure out what to do.
Right.
And we've been doing our best. And what you need to understand, what the fans need to understand, is that the players moved in the owner's direction, notwithstanding enormous backwards move from the owners in terms of their initial proposal. So that's a long way around saying the following. If we ever have an additional proposal that we can make today, tonight, tomorrow, next week, whenever it is, we're not going to be bashful about making it. We're not going to stand on ceremony. We're not going to hold back. We're not going to play tit for tat games or anything like that. But when I said that it's up to the owners to avoid the lockout, what I was meant was precisely this. This is a lockout of choice. They don't have to do this. They could say we won't lock out for another 4 or 5 days to negotiate to see if we can still make training camps. They could say we'll open training camps and then, you know, if we have to lock out, we'll do it at the beginning of the season. They could continue to negotiate. They have chosen not to do that. And one thing that Gary has said in the past, I don't know if he said it today, but one thing he said in the past is that, you know, we were told as long ago as last November they wouldn't go another season under the current situation. Well, back then, if they were already talking about a lockout, the only proposal they could have known about was theirs. And when you make proposals like they did, you ought not to be surprised when the players react as they did.
Have you ever been in all your years? I've seen, we're counting it up. I've seen 11 lockouts or strikes in professional sport and over 20 negotiations during my career. What I find interesting about the early days, and I think they might still be early days of this one, is less time spent locked in the room negotiating. But at the same time, we have had three offers and three counteroffers in a fairly small window. What's different about this than almost any other negotiation I've seen or you, Don, have ever been a part of?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it is all that different.
Okay, fair.
Some of the other ones that I have been a part of. You can turn things around pretty quickly. You can't always turn it around on a dime, and there's two reasons for that. You got work to do. You got evaluations to make. You have judgments that have to come into play. And on our side, at least, we have 700 constituents, and we need to contact a representative number of them to make sure that we're on the same page as the players are. After all, we work for them. So you could see that and so on. But I'm not sure this is all that different from prior negotiations that I've been a part of, in which you do have flurries of activity, and sometimes that leads to an agreement, and sometimes it leads to periods of lesser activity.
Don, Gary Bettman made at least passing reference today to the settlements in the National Football League and the NBA that came after lockouts, as though they had kind of reset the bar, that this negotiation takes place in the wake of those negotiations, and therefore that those deals have to be taken into account. Do you feel that you're negotiating against those deals in any way, or that you should be negotiating against those deals in any way?
I think that's just a construct, and I think nobody pretends it's anything more than that. If it was anything more than that, you would hear somebody saying, we need this amount of money to go from this player or this team to this other team because. You don't have any of that. All you hear is, well, football players took less and basketball players took less, so who the heck do hockey players think they are? Back in 04, what I am told is that the position of the NHL was, we have to have the cap because we're different than the other ones. Then hockey economics on its own demands it. Now they're saying, well, gee, look at basketball and football. What they don't say, of course, is look at baseball. Baseball is the only sport that's stable now on a labor relations basis. There hasn't been a hint of a problem in more than a decade and a half. Several agreements in a row negotiated without any meaningful difficulty. Baseball, lo and behold, has no cap. And what that means is, among other things, that if I have a franchise and I want to spend a lot less, I can. And if I want to spend a lot more, I can. What does that mean? It means that owners are sort of expected to manage their franchises like all businesses are expected to do. So we could say, in much the same way, look at baseball, let's do it that way. We don't think that's a productive way to reach an agreement, and we don't think, you know, bringing over other sports who don't have the same economics would. You know, I suppose we could say that if they had $12 billion in revenue like the NFL or whatever it is, maybe we take the NFL number, but somehow I don't think that'll get us to an agreement.
Don, with Don Fehr, the executive director of the NHLPA, clearly you managed to forge labor peace while you were the head of the Major League Baseball Players Association, and that labor peace was executed principally with Bud Selig as the commissioner. Categorize your relationship with Bud and whether that relationship was a factor in labor peace or whether it was purely the mathematics and the negotiating at some point that led you to an understanding that allowed you to renew deals essentially without dispute.
Well, let me say a couple of things about that. And as you know, and as many of the people listening may know, we had our share of battles in baseball.
Oh, yeah.
For a sustained period of time.
Right.
By the time we got to when the 96 agreement was made, which was what created the revenue sharing, which creates the stability, in my judgment, over there. It's not the only thing. A lot of pieces go in, but it's a big part of it. parties were sitting around and saying, how do we devise something so we don't automatically fall back into, gee, I want more, gee, I want less, whatever it is, in sort of a very simplistic type of negotiation, which is what exists in basketball and football and in hockey, apparently. And we were able eventually to work something out which allowed us to do that. And a lot of it's the mathematics, a lot of it's the financial issues, but also a lot of it is the basic respect for one another and their positions and treating each other as more or less equal partners when you're at the table to try and figure out how to do this. Bud has, I must say, one advantage, I think, on any other commissioner that I have ever met in any sport, and that is that he ran a team.
Right.
And whatever else that does or doesn't do, it does give him a perspective that is different. Whether that was meaningful in our trying to put together the agreements which eventually created that stability, I don't really know. I'd sort of be interested now that I'm thinking about it to ask Bud.
So do you see anything in your early days with the NHLPA that suggest you might be able to fashion an agreement that would create a more amicable, longer-lasting relationship such as you were able to forge with baseball? Or are we not even close to that?
I think the answer to that is I think I see ways to do that. I think I see roadmaps to do that. I hope that eventually we'll be able to find ways to do that. So far, at least, you know, at the kind of enmity and bitterness which seemed to pervade the last negotiations here and in 94 seemed to be absent. I hope that continues. And we see, because I think in the end, if somehow we can work together, and that requires give and take, and it requires parties on both sides to respect one another and respect each other's views, and for them to treat the union as somebody other than a party with whom they're going to work to reduce the union members' salaries. Maybe we can do some things. I took this job for essentially two reasons. Far and away, the most important was that I got to know players. I really like them, and I really think they're terrific, and I wanted to try and help them. But the other reason was that I think this sport is poised, if it isn't screwed up, to really do some great things. And, you know, I was thinking back. Right before the baseball players had their troubles in the summer of 94, the Rangers won the Stanley Cup. And
that's
there
right.
was, if my memory is right, a big cover story in Sports Illustrated talking about how hockey's the great new sport and it's
yep.
going to go great guns and it took over the Big Apple and all the rest of it. And, of course, what followed was a lockout. And then here we are now, and we have the Stanley Cup won by a Sun Belt team in an enormous market, right?
The LA Kings.
We don't want to screw that up again, do we?
Apparently.
Don, if there, you know, the concept of revenue sharing has come up a couple times in this conversation. I know it's a big part of what the players proposed, but it seems to be a non-starter with the commissioner and with the owners right now. If it is, if they're not willing to go farther down that road, can you build the kind of relationship you're talking about? Can you build the business you're talking about?
I don't want to say it's impossible, but my experience is that makes it easier. But that's far and away not the only thing. There are a lot of other things that go into that. But that piece of it was one of the things which created the construct that I think has led to stability there.
We know you got to go. One very quick question. Mr. Bettman indicated that he was awaiting a response or a call from you. Have you made it? Will you make it? Is there a chance you guys will get together again before Saturday?
No, I assume that there's more than a chance that will take place. But, you know, I just want to caution you about something, and I think this goes without saying. One of the tactics which is often used in public relations disputes is to say, just we're waiting on the other guy, here's his phone number.
Sure.
Just bear that in mind.